Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and those of you listening yesterday at this time heard us talk to Richard Cohen, the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center, about their new report documenting an increase in the number of hate groups in America since Trump was inaugurated as president. But how did the white nationalist movement evolve to the point where it ditched the hoods for khakis and polos and wound up with a president they actually really like in the White House? Journalist Vegas Tenold has been following the white nationalist group since 2010, and he has a new book called Everything You Love Will Burn. He chronicles his time spent traveling and embedding with various factions of the so-called alt-right and profiles their quest to make white nationalism not only more popular, but what they see as respectable again, if it was ever respectable. Vegas, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So is your thesis kind of different from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which I think sees them as a rising threat, and you see them as, you know, heinous, despicable, deplorable, but we pay too much attention to them at our peril?
Well, I think, you know, the report that just came out from the SPLC says that they've been they're an increasing presence. They've grown, and I think that's true. But I think also 2017 has shown that although they've certainly become a movement of some force, they still don't know what to do with that power. They don't know how to translate it into anything but the same kind of group of malcontents that they've always been. So sure, they're a presence, but we don't really know what that means yet. And my point in the book is that we also have other forms of white supremacy in this country that we need to pay equal, if not more, attention to.
So if we pay too much attention to the remnants or the new generation of the Klan and neo-Nazi groups and things like that, then we might risk ignoring deep embedded structural racism, which affects more people of color day by day?
Sure, sure. But I mean, I think it's important that you think about both things. And I certainly wouldn't have spent the last 7 years with the neo-Nazis and the KKK and the skinheads if I thought they weren't a thing. Their points of view have informed a lot of the opinions and ideology that came out of the 2016 election. And, you know, you hear things that I heard in Klan rallies and neo-Nazi rallies in 2011 being said, you know, in the halls of power now. So I think absolutely, if you want to try to understand the form of nationalism we're seeing around us today, then it's important to see where it's coming from. And it's important to try to understand its most extreme incarnations.
What did you set out to look for with your research for this book that people didn't already know about white nationalism in America?
Well, for me, it was a kind of a personal project. I was just curious because, you know, the idea of national socialism is such an anachronism. It is the most hated ideology in the Western world.
That's sort of what Nazi stood for, right? National socialism.
And when I found this group, which was the first group I started following, the National Socialist Movement, these were people in 2011 America who would march under a swastika. And I thought, why would anyone ever do that? I mean, why would anyone choose the most hated piece of art, piece of graphic, the swastika, and choose to march under it? So I wanted to find out why they were willing to bear the considerable social cost of being an out-and-out Nazi. And so I was kind of just curious.
And what did you learn about why people would do it? Was it for different reasons than you might have expected?
A lot of the reasons kind of were expected. I mean, people want to belong to something, and people feel lost, and people feel adrift, and some people feel angry, and they want to belong, and you know, there's a sense of, to these groups, there can be a sense of family, but you know, I think the underlying reason is racism. It is a profound fear and distrust of others.
We were just talking this week about the false accusation against one of the students from the high school in Parkland, Florida, who came out for gun control afterwards, David Hogg. rumor started circulating about him, a vicious, intentionally started rumor by someone that he wasn't really a student in the high school. He was a so-called crisis actor trying to capitalize for either personal gain or, you know, leftist political purposes on the tragedy at the high school. Well, you have something in your book where a white nationalist tells you about Sandy Hook victims in Connecticut allegedly being actors, right?
Yeah. Well, their worldview very much depends on the notion that they're under siege and that kind of everything that happened has a nefarious underlying reason, and that they're kind of So all efforts of gun control or liberal policies have to be the result of some nefarious force working against white people. So this kind of conspiratorial mindset is very, very common.
Listeners, if you have a question for Vegas Tenold, author of Everything You Love Will Burn, in which he chronicles several years spent embedding in a certain respect with factions of white supremacists and neo-Nazis. I guess they're that. Well, I'm going to ask you about terminology in a second. But the book is called Everything You Love Will Burn. If you have a question for him, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. KKK, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, are they all the same?
They are and they aren't. Kind of. I get the impulse that you just want to call everyone a neo-Nazi, and that's, you know, kind of fine. But I also wanted my book to be, you know, if not scholarly, then certainly journalistically
sound.
Sound. Yes, exactly. So to me, it kind of made sense to differentiate a little bit. And the Klan doesn't necessarily agree with the National Socialists, the neo-Nazis, on all things. They certainly don't agree with the skinheads. And this becomes a lot of isms and sort of a lot of small differences to those of us on the outside. But I wanted as much as I could to explain this. And I feel like terminology does matter. And you know, an example of that is the term the alt-right, which kind of doesn't mean anything, but it implies that this is this new alternative form of nationalism, whereas their ideology and, you know, their ideas are just kind of the same old hodgepodge of racism and nationalism that we've seen for decades. There's nothing new, and calling it something new can be misleading.
And in fact, I think a lot of the news media has wised up to the term alt-right. And now if we say it at all, we say so-called alt-right. Because when you say alt-right, it sounds kind of friendly, kind of fun. It sounds like an indie rock radio format. It's alternative right, you know. So who made that up and for what public relations purpose?
Well, that was Richard Spencer who came up with that in, I believe it was 2008. He bought the website altright.com, I think it was. And I think for him, it was about kind of differentiating himself within the movement. But when we in the media discovered, you know, Richard Spencer and his ilk in 2015, 2016, then we thought, alt-right, what an interesting term. I guess we'll use that. It becomes tempting.
There is a main character in your book, kind of a guy who you follow more than anyone, named Matthew Heimbach. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
So I met Matthew, the first time I met Matthew was at a Klan rally in 2011 in North Carolina. Neither of us can kind of remember meeting the other, but that's, we've talked about it since, and that's where we met. When I met him later, the first time we kind of talked properly, he was the leader of a group of organizations called the White Student Union, It was chapters of a white student union at several colleges. He was making a name for himself as a kind of new voice on the scene. He would say things like, this isn't about white supremacy. I'm not saying the white race is better than anyone else. It's just that it's my race. And you know, some people believed him, some people didn't. But the point was that he would phrase himself in a new way. And he was gregarious and he was talkative and he was good with the media. And I found him interesting. So when I heard about his plan of sort of gathering the far right, I thought, okay, if I piggyback with him, then it'll give me an introduction to what's moving out there.
And so he became a window into the beliefs and also the factionalism, where, you know, out of the view of most mainstream Americans who aren't paying attention to them at this level of detail, they compete with themselves at various levels.
Sure. I mean, I would say apart from Congress, the far right is probably the most dysfunctional place in America. And the challenge for, you know, innumerable leaders throughout the years have been, you know, how do we gather this? How do we take it from a bickering group of malcontents into something that we can, something that has some power? And it's failed time and time again. But Matthew seemed to believe that he could do it. And in a way, he did, and in a way, he didn't. You know, the book follows his work trying to build an alliance of sorts. And by the end of the book, he did. But it wasn't the alliance he set out to build.
So on that alliance, if there is a main policy goal of the white nationalist movement, as you documented it in your book, is there one?
Well, yeah, they're nothing if not ambitious. I mean, their end goal is the so-called white ethno-state. And they seem to believe that, and that's kind of changed as well. Now they don't see themselves as American nationalists anymore because they believe, as they say, that the American empire has left them behind and that needs to kind of go down in flames for them to rebuild something else. So sure, their end goal is a white ethno-state. Some people think that that'll be the outcome of a racial holy war. Matthew says that he believes it could be an amicable divorce sort of thing. You know, we'll give these people their cities and we'll take ours and we'll trade. We'll just be, which is, you know, unrealistic to say the very least. But sure, that's their end goal.
Rayon in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Vegas Tenold, author of Everything You Love Will Burn. Hi, Rayon.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Thank you for having me. Long-time listener and third-time caller.
Glad you're
Quick
in.
Quick question for your guest. So these neo-Nazis and alt-right characters that we've been referring to, when they realize that Donald Trump is not the candidate they truly thought he was going to be, do you anticipate seeing more hardcore individuals come into the limelight? So is Trump the beginning of this or is he the end of this?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a very, very good question. So they have a very much when life gives you lemon, make lemonade way of thinking about this. And, you know, going into 2017, they were riding high and they thought Trump is our guy, which it turns out for various reasons that he wasn't. He disappointed them in a million small ways, which they kind of said, OK, well, he's our foot in the door. He's not the guy we thought he would be, but he's a proof of concept. He showed us that America is ready for a leader with nationalist ideas. But I think we've seen throughout 2017, they've had several attempts at, you know, giving speeches and rallies that have all descended, you know, sometimes tragically into violence. And many of my sources have told me that, you know, there's no use in being political anymore. Matthew Heimbach told me after Charlottesville that if you want to be a nationalist, you have to get your helmet, you have to get your shield and your armor and get ready to march in the street. So I think absolutely, as they become more disappointed in the way Trump turned out and in the way, you know, society deals with them, I think you'll see a much harder edge to their nationalism.
So are they disappointed with the way Trump is turning out? A lot of our listeners might be surprised to hear that.
I think they are. And I mean, certainly, you know, one of the first things he did was he lobbed a bunch of missiles at Syria. That was early in his administration. And they were disappointed for a few reasons. I mean, he said he wouldn't start a war. They'd see Assad as a leader in a region full of barbarians. And also, it was a betrayal in their eyes towards Putin, who they, you know, love very much. Then there was his budget that took a lot of money from the Appalachian region. So, you know, for various reasons, they've been disappointed. But then, you know, every time he says stuff like he'll end DACA, and every time he builds the wall, then they're on his side again because that's all they really care about. They say that he can be the worst president ever. If he builds that wall, it'll be worth it.
Neo-Nazis and neo-Klansmen love Vladimir Putin.
Russia has emerged as the beacon of white nationalism for Western countries, for European countries, for Western countries. You know, Putin is building his Russian identity around this kind of nationalism, this pan-European nationalism. He has very anachronistic views on gay marriage, gay rights, women, all that kind of stuff. So, yes, they see him as the leader they want.
How much do you think Trump's constant currying favor with Putin is a way to appeal to this base? He does so many things to appeal to this base. And also tell us how many votes you think this base actually represented in the 2016 election.
I don't want to speculate as to why Trump seems to be unable to stand up to Putin. I'm sure there are very many reasons for that, but certainly this is one of them, because you know Putin is popular with this set. I don't know how exactly it impacted the votes in this election. I mean, in the days following the election, people seem to be scrambling to figure out what happened, and I think race was certainly a part of it, but And again, I don't like using this term, the alt-right was at that time and still is a very online, anonymous movement. So it's hard to quantify how many votes that translated into.
Tracy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Tracy.
Hi.
Hi. Real quick, we've got about 20 seconds for you. What's your question?
Okay. In the group that you were embedded in, how many women were there, and how many of them experienced in their previous life and in the group sexual, physical, mental, emotional abuse?
Great question.
As to the latter part of that question, I can't really speak to it. No one told me about abuse. But women in the movement is an interesting aspect of it. There aren't many female leaders in the movement. There are female members, certainly, but a lot of them see society in a very traditional way. Matthew, you know, one day we were out driving and we had his kid in the car because his wife Brooke was at home getting a day off. And Matthew said that she was playing Skyrim, which is this computer game that has a huge open world. And Brooke would kind of just, you know, you could slay dragons, but she would just potter around the house making virtual potions from virtual herbs. So they see, you know, they see women's role as sort of, you know, make white babies and raise white families kind of thing. And yeah.
And Richard Cohen from the Southern Poverty Law Center mentioned on yesterday's show that there are at least two anti-woman hate groups that the SPLC has documented in the last year. You know, usually we think of this in racial terms or anti-LGBT, that kind of thing, but specifically anti-woman, what they label hate groups.
Yeah.
Did you come upon this?
They wouldn't say they hated women, but certainly their ideas about what a woman's place should be is deeply misogynistic, and many would say hateful. I was once in a coffee shop with Richard Spencer, and he was telling me about how women shouldn't be in college. A young woman overheard it and came over and basically just tore into Richard in the greatest way I've ever seen, just completely dressing him down.
Would you say that the people who you met in your research for this book were largely that patriarchal?
Yes, on the whole, yes. Absolutely.
And I guess we will leave it there with Vegas Tenold, journalist who's been following white nationalist groups since 2010. And his research has now culminated in a book called Everything You Love Will Burn. And if you're intrigued enough by this to want to see Vegas Tenold in person, he'll be doing a reading at the Half King on 23rd and 10th in Chelsea, Monday night at 7 o'clock. Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Half King in Chelsea. By the way, you're originally from Norway, aren't you?
Born and raised, yeah.
President wants more people like you. Did you know that?
Yeah, I'll bring them all over.
There'll be a lot more European socialists, wouldn't
you? Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much.